broadcasting from Melbourne, Victoria. You're listening to The Investor Exchange. Tune in each week and listen to the guys from United Global Capital discuss the topics that matter the most to your finances. Each episode will help you separate the noise from what really matters, giving you timely and actionable information you can use. We'll cover areas related to financial markets, property, politics, personal finance, and the economy. Now, here's your host, Stephanie Sumner.
Hello, listeners. Welcome to this week's episode of The Investor Exchange. I'm your host today, Louis van Copenhagen. Steph is calling in absent. And joining me in the studio is Joel Hewish.
Good morning, Louis. Good morning, listeners.
And Brett Dickinson.
Good morning. It's good to see the staples always here.
Exactly.
The core of the group.
We're the foundation.
Yep.
Holding down the fort. Fellas, what's been happening in your weeks?
Oh, wow. We've had a big week of travel, actually. Got quite a few new, investment opportunities that we're trying to patch together. And we had some very good meetings over the past 3 days.
Yeah, it was productive.
Very productive. Yeah. So watch this space. Over the next few months, there could be some new investment opportunities presenting.
Yep. Very good. That's exciting.
It is.
Always good to hear. Always good to hear. Joel, you've got something in the news that you want to talk about.
Yes, I do. So do I. Well, when I first saw this article, I thought to myself, God, I would like to punch this guy in the face. But then I thought, no, I'm just one man, and maybe I should throw it out to an open forum and figure out whether or not
we're talking about Dom Sheed, right?
I'm the crazy one, or whether or not he's the crazy one, or maybe the world's just going crazy. I'm not too sure. So. I was actually having a bit of a scroll through Facebook last night, and I came across this article where a gentleman by the name of Mark McVeigh has decided that he is going to sue Rest Superannuation based on inaction around climate change, or not considering climate change enough in their investment policy and investment framework. Whoa. So, I've got I'm just reading from an article here. So in July, a landmark trial will take place in a Sydney courtroom that could potentially change the way superannuation funds invest Australians almost $3 trillion in retirement savings. Now, Mark McVeigh can't access his super until 2055, but says climate change impacts are already materializing and therefore investors should be acting. And it's his belief that Rest hasn't done enough to address those concerns, and as such, he is suing them for failure to act in the best interest of their members. So, look, I have a view on this.
It's an interesting case, isn't it?
But it is an interesting case.
Could be quite polarizing too.
And my initial thought was when I read this, I said, my initial thought was, mate, if it's really bothering you that much, there are plenty of ethical and environmental funds to go and choose from, funds. And then I was sort of thinking, well, the primary reason for or the primary responsibility for a superannuation trustee is to really make decisions for the broader good of all members, and their mandate is not, I don't believe, and I don't think I have seen a mandate so far, is to actually consider the impact of climate. I think that their mandate is to produce returns in a steady way and manage risk. And my initial thoughts were, well, who is the lawyer taking advantage of this poor sucker and trying to get some fees from, get some fees here?
I bet he's not paying them. I bet there's law firms or people funding him.
Trying to test this case. Yeah, he's just the poster boy, I guess.
Yeah.
My initial thought on this was, buddy, if you don't like it, there's plenty of other options to go to. And my other thought on this is, I'm not so sure that investing in ethical or environmentally focused investment funds is necessarily going to do much anyway. I think you'd have more impact by not buying the goods and services of companies you believe are emitters or polluters. And I'm assuming this guy probably drives a car and probably catches a plane to go and have a holiday and probably buys bottled water or something like that. So, you know, I think he would probably have more of an impact by changing his consumer behaviours, which actually hits the companies at their top and bottom line, rather than being just a passive secondary investor, staying away from shares that really have no actual impact on the performance of the business or the decisions that the business would make. The thing that really hits businesses is whether or not their revenues are increasing or decreasing. So anyway, I thought I'd open it up to you guys today to have a chat and figure out whether or not I'm crazy or the world's going crazy or he's the crazy one.
I think your opinion of whether he's crazy or not depends on your opinion of how much action is required on climate change. If I read a study of actually six different categories of people, whether they are extremely alarmed about climate change. On the other side of the spectrum, people who are completely dismissive about climate change and varying degrees of it in between. Mm. So there's going to be people on one side who are saying, yes, this guy's right on the money and go for it, mate. But then there's people on the other side who are like, well, climate change isn't real, so this guy is just crazy, so stuff it.
But then there's a broader question here in regards to, well, what is the responsibility of the trustee to give a damn about climate change?
That's
well,
the second part, isn't it?
That's interesting. So what is the legal obligation? And the legal obligation of a super fund is to act for the sole purpose of providing retirement benefits for its members. Mm-hmm. And I think the way it was written was clearly intended to provide investment returns for its members.
Yeah.
However, the words, even though they might have been written with that intention, here's what's going to be tested in that court case is, well, what does retirement benefits mean?
Is it quality of environment?
That's right. So is it part of a super fund's responsibility to consider what the world might look like when that person reaches retirement? And that's the crux of his argument. So what is a retirement benefit?
Yeah. Because it's not clearly defined as a purely financially
beneficial
position.
So then I think they would go back and test what was the intent of the law, because probably a lot of this legislation was drafted before climate change was really even a thing.
Yeah, not on the radar.
Well, like these matters, it's going to go through the Supreme Court and then it's going to be appealed and then it's going to go higher and higher to the highest, where there'll be, I don't know what it is, a panel of judges.
High Court.
The High Court. Mm. And it will probably split according to their political leanings on climate change.
I would hope not. I would hope it would come down to the practicalities of what the intention of the superannuation system is trying to achieve. You know, I guess that maybe that's just me being a little bit pragmatic here. But look, at the end of the day, as an investment manager, I know myself. I mean, I tend to we don't recommend tobacco companies and alcohol companies and resource businesses. But I'm not investing for an ethical reason. They just are bad businesses to be involved in.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like, you know, they're already dominant in their industry. They're saturated. They're contracting. You know, they are highly cyclical in many instances, capital intensive. You know, a lot of these businesses just don't make good sense from a business perspective. Mm. But, yeah.
And with the way that the general consensus of consumers is going, the general consensus is that climate change action is required. More than 60% of the Australian public shows that from polling. Mm. So those companies who are engaged in resource-intensive or fossil fuel industries, they're going to have headwinds from the consumers of Australia.
Correct.
So their businesses are going to have a bit more of a struggle than other companies.
And this is where I think that the focus on ethical or environmental investing, or you know, whatever that broad, you know, what do they call it, the ESG movement. What does it stand for?
ESG,
ethical
is
and social responsibility.
Yes, or, and governance.
And governance. Yes. Yep. So that movement is a great step forward. But if you really want to hit a company, and you want to hit them hard, don't buy their products.
Yeah. And get a lot of your friends and family not to buy
it.
Yeah,
force them to make changes. Force them to clean up their practices by boycotting their products.
Yep.
The challenge, services. The challenge for that, though, is probably the major contributor to climate change is energy production.
Yep. Yeah.
And it's pretty hard to just not buy energy.
It is. It is. So when it comes to climate change activism, and any activism, actually, what is always pursued is every possible avenue. Mm. So at the end of the chain, yes, you've got consumers, and you've got consumers who are able to change their behavior. You know, you can buy lettuce in a plastic bag from the supermarket, or you can buy the loose leaf lettuce. You can buy bottled water, or you cannot, and you can choose your energy provider. You can do these things as a consumer to a certain extent, because if you're in Woolworths right now, and they've only got lettuce in plastic bags, that's then right. You've got no choice.
Yep.
So then there needs to be pressure on the businesses to actually pay some concern towards it. This is what consumers want, and we're going to put pressure on you as a business to provide those options and be more considerate.
Well, and financial resource comes into it too, because a lot of people can't afford the more environmentally friendly option. A lot of the time it's more expensive.
A lot of the time it is more expensive. That's right. But some of those changes will come with economies of scale as it comes more into play.
Yeah.
And then there are other avenues where activists will place pressure. They'll place pressure on the financing side of it, which is what you're talking about here. So if a company's share price is lower, then maybe their ability to do business is lower. And then there's the political pressures at different stages. You've got pressure on federal, you've got pressure on local governments, and all sorts of things there. So activists are trying to put pressure on all stages of this process. And this is an example of just another one.
So his name's Mark McVeigh, was that right, Joel?
Mark McVeigh,
so we'll probably see him on the news someday with Greta Thunberg.
Possibly.
Yeah. Possibly.
Or in SN drug scandal or something like that.
Yeah, the names.
Yeah. Yep. That's right. So, look, if he's unsuccessful, what's going to happen? Well, if he's unsuccessful, then there won't be any change in the super segment. What if he is successful and superannuation fund trustees who are investors of more than $1 trillion?
$3 trillion.
$3 trillion in share markets. What's going to happen?
I think there'll need to be some sort of ratings or something that'll come out to say these are what we consider environmentally, you know, viable or friendly businesses.
Mm.
So there must be some way that they can say, well, this is one, this isn't, for when you're investing.
Yep. I suspect what would probably happen is that most superannuation funds would, rather than completely, you know, dump BHP Billiton and Rio Tinto and Woodside Petroleum and any of these others, would probably create a ESG, ethical, environmental option.
Yeah.
And give their members a choice to perhaps move out of the default option.
Well, the choice is already there. And I think where they're trying to head is for the majority of Australians that don't make a choice on their super, these so-called My Super options, where people just have a super fund because their employer put them there. That's where I think the real change might happen. That's where the majority of the superannuation industry's money sits. So if trustees of super funds are going to change that default option, then they're really the ones who are controlling the majority of superannuation money. So I'll be interested to see what happens from this court case, and then I'll be interested to see what happens as a result of that. But you're already seeing companies react. So you're seeing companies like BHP, and there's a lot of shareholder activism happening on BHP as well, but they are already turning towards trying to be more environmentally conscious.
Sure.
As environmentally conscious as you can, being a mining company, but doing things not just for the pure financial returns of it, but actually looking at their sources of energy and considering it.
And how they manage the land that they're operating on and all of that sort of stuff. Absolutely.
Correct.
And all of that is a positive, right? Like, no one's arguing that, you know, that's not a good thing.
No.
Whether or not you're a climate skeptic or not, no one wants dirty rivers and, you know, pollution and, you know, all that sort of stuff.
More sustainable processes are always going to be beneficial.
Correct.
Yep. That's right. So I'm looking at these My Super products and the way the regulator's talking about it, I've been looking at this in the news from a different angle and it's got me a little bit frustrated.
Yeah.
The regulator's come out with a comparison of these MySuper products where people don't make a choice.
Yep.
And they're looking at, oh, well, which ones are the high fee ones and we're going to name and shame them. And they come out with a list of super funds that have higher fees in their investment options. And they measure them, they just rank them, high fees and low fees. And there's this simple equation, which unfortunately has been set up, that high fees equals low returns.
Yeah.
I'm not going to say there's no correlation. There's certainly, if a super fund has higher fees, then they it does create a potential for them to have lower returns. But if they have higher fees, then you would think they're doing something extra with those fees.
Correct.
Yep. So you've got a lot of really good performing super funds and investment options that get a bad rap because they're high fee. Mm. And you need to look at, well, what is the actual return?
Yeah.
And that's what the regulator doesn't do.
Net outcome.
That's right.
Yeah.
The other thing the regulator focuses on is what has that equation been for the last 12 months?
Mm. Mm.
And anyone who's in investment management knows that 12 months is too short a time period to judge any one investment strategy over another.
Absolutely.
So where the super funds are concerned is that it's going to create more crowding. Mm-hmm. The super funds want less crowding, not more crowding. Mm-hmm. And what do I mean by crowding? What I mean is where all super funds kind of just invest in the same way because they're all shit scared about being at the at the top of the worst performers list.
Yep. Yeah.
For a 12-month period of time.
Yep. Yeah.
But in order to be a great long-term performer, you have to be at the top of that list from time to time.
Yeah.
Because there's going to be 12-month periods of time where the market just doesn't favor a certain investment strategy.
Yep.
You can have the best performing investment strategy over the long term and it's going to have a 6 or 12-month period where it doesn't perform well.
Yep.
Yep, absolutely true. Yep.
So I get a bit frustrated by this, but again, it's a bit of a communication issue for the public because the regulator has to come out with something to try and better engage the general public who have superannuation funds and they're not engaged with it.
They're trying to dumb this down into a simple method of assessing what's good and what's bad, but. Yep. But it's like everything in life. It's never, ever quite black and white.
No, no. So I just wish, good on them for trying to dumb it down and trying to engage people, but just do it on a good basis.
Yeah.
Mm. Just don't do it on 12 months.
Yeah, exactly.
Yep. And don't do it with this high fees equals a bad fund.
And what they should really be doing is, like you said, Louis, you know, let's show the returns before fees, after fees on a one-year basis, 3 year, 5 year, 7 year, 10 year, something like that.
Yep. 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 Exactly. So that's my beef with the news.
Understandable.
Very good.
Yes.
Very good.
Yes. Well, anyway, should we get into our topics for the day?
Yes.
Since we're talking about investors and share market strategies, why don't we kick off with Joel?
Sure. Well, I'd like to have a bit of a chat about Tesla.
Mm.
Tesla is flying at the moment. Yeah.
Is it really?
It is flying.
Amazing.
The share price is now up above $500 where it was as low as $180 just back in June of last year.
Wow.
Now it's actually up about $640. I pulled up the chart. So yesterday it was $580. Last night it's just closed at $640. That's incredible. So what's going on at Tesla? Well, they have been able to turn around their production issues. They're actually starting to turn a bit of a profit now as well, and they've done that a little bit consistently.
Hey.
But the concern for me around Tesla is at this point now is, okay, look, great work, Elon. You know, you've proven the doubters wrong so far, and keep it up. I guess the real issue now is, you know, Tesla's now a $100 billion company.
Yep.
It's bigger than Ford and GM combined.
Wow.
In terms of valuation. But the numbers that Tesla is likely to produce in terms of cars delivered over this 12-month stretch over the next 12 months is around about 500,000 cars. Now, to put that into perspective, in 2017, Tesla wouldn't have even produced half of the 21st largest car producer at 500,000. So Mitsubishi in 2017 was the 21st produced the 21st most cars in 2017 or motor vehicles at 1.21 million.
Wow.
So Tesla has a valuation that is, and if we have a look at Ford, Ford produced 6.38 million cars in 2017. Whoa. And General Motors produced 6.856 million cars.
Jeez.
So you put those two car makers together, Ford and GM, which are ranked fifth and sixth, and they've produced around just over 13 million cars in 2017. Yet the valuation of Tesla is more than Ford and GM combined, and yet Tesla's only made 500,000, is likely to make only 500,000 cars.
Less than a tenth, wow.
On the issue of Tesla's valuation, though, I read an article about a month ago when it was just under 500, but it got to that value where it was considered to be the largest US automaker ever in terms of value. The issue with the valuation, though, is Tesla's not just a car company. It's got its energy. It's got all the other things. So one of the analyses or comparisons I saw was it's a bit like saying, well, Google have their phones. So given Google's valuation, they're the biggest phone manufacturer on the planet.
Right.
No, they're not.
Okay.
So Tesla's valuation, it's can you take out just the car manufacturing side of it away from the rest of its business and value that alone and then compare it with GM and Ford.
Okay.
Well, interesting. I haven't actually done the analysis, but the vast majority of its revenues is driven by the cars.
The cars, yeah.
Yeah, the batteries are there. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it plays around in a few other little things, but overwhelmingly, you know, you're talking sort of more than 90% of its revenues come from car sales.
Mm. Right. So you'd look at based on revenue, 90% of its valuation being on cars, its operations.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it would probably therefore still have it as the largest automaker.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Okay.
But it's not solely that business.
Even if you halved the value of Tesla completely, the amount of production of cars is less than a tenth of Ford and GM combined. Mm. So it's still highly.
How many did you say they were making? 500,000?
500,000. They're on track to make 500,000 cars this year.
So. Well, they're less than a 20th.
That's
when you combine the other two.
That's right.
Less than a 20th.
Like 5%
both of them combined.
And yet
the valuation is greater than the two of them combined.
Wow.
So there's a major disconnect between how one group of investors is valuing a car company versus how they're valuing another group of car companies. Mm. And obviously, you know, the obvious concern that you have here is that there is just way, way, way too much optimism and euphoria in this stock at the moment. But I've never seen a company create so much polarization and so much emotional response.
Well, here's the thing. So for your everyday consumer, they might really love a particular share and they might buy that as a direct investment. But when you've got a company that is this big, it doesn't get to such heighty share prices without some deep pockets behind it.
Yeah.
So you've got to have institutional investors and fund managers that are very bullish on the growth of this stock in order to get that price.
Yeah. Yeah.
So is that just the Elon Musk effect, or is it really a sense of being a great company?
Well, look, there's the concern that I have, though, is that right now, where you're seeing Tesla share price. If you're a new investor, if you were smart enough to get into share price at $180 or even $200 or $300, then good on you.
Not even smart. If you were enough of a risk taker, because I remember that was your concern, Joel.
Yeah.
It wasn't about it being a great product or not. It was about its financial position
and its
ability to turn around its production. So it would have been a risky play.
Yeah, absolutely, and it's just got even more risky right now.
Mm.
What you're banking on, though, if you're buying shares of Tesla at this current share price, is you're expecting Tesla's future to be like the rosiest.
Yeah. Yeah, for that share price
outcome,
to grow.
Right. Yeah. The rosiest beyond outcome that, yeah. that anyone could probably, you know, imaginably fathom.
Yep. Mm.
And for it not to have any mistakes or hiccups mm-hmm. or bumps along the way. And like, you know, it's...
Well, you're valuing the future growth, aren't you?
Yeah.
And you're saying, I'm going to invest it in it today, betting that it will get its production to be 20 times higher in future or its profit levels to be...
Well, even more than that, you're saying 40 times because remember, it's producing. It's yep. it's twice, it's greater than
yep.
Ford and GM combined.
Yeah.
Yep.
So are they expecting it to reach those volumes?
So yep. so you would have to be
and
expecting
profitability.
That, yeah, you would yep. have to be expecting that Tesla's going to be selling not 13 million cars, yeah. but somewhere around 26 20, million
yes.
cars.
Yeah. Yeah.
And which with is good more margins,
than yeah, and with good margins, driven. Which is yeah, and you know, look, car manufacturing is notoriously a capital intensive business mm-hmm. in a and highly competitive.
Yep.
That's why car manufacturers have been traditionally a really horrible business to be involved in.
Yeah.
It's like airplanes. If you go back 100 years and, you know, with the first creation of an airplane or a car and you predicted that, you know, the huge growth and adoption of car usage and flight would lead to a huge boom in profits for these types of businesses, I think that that would be a fair and reasonable
yeah.
assumption.
Yeah,
however,
I think.
None of them have really been able to produce consistently growing profits
yep. mm.
over an extended period of, you know, 70, 80 years because there's no real competitive advantage. You're making hardware which others can copy, can come up with better designs yep. or, you know, you've always got this ebb and flow between this car's hot, then this car's hot, yep. you know,
yeah.
and you've got a lot of capital that is required to go and design those cars, to develop them, to produce them, to manufacture them, and you've got to get your sales right, sales estimates right as well.
Yep. Yep.
It's just a very tough business to be involved in, and
it is
over the long term at these prices is a risky
so would,
proposition.
Would Tesla tick the box for Rest Super to invest in then? Is it environmentally sustainable?
Well, they're positioned in their branding that way for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah, but if they're going to grow, well, then there's got to be if you're an investor bullish on Tesla, you got to be assuming that competitors don't do much. But that's an incorrect assumption because yeah.
they're going to innovate. They're going to continue to evolve.
Yeah,
of course
they will.
But so will the competitors. Yeah,
yeah that's right.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah.
Competitors.
You think Mercedes isn't working on their electric cars yeah. right now and their BMW driverless
and,
cars
yeah,
and
yeah.
BMW and Toyota? The differences between them. Sure, maybe Tesla will have a 1 or 2 year head start, but that'll be it.
Yeah.
Then it'll be copied and replicated.
Mm.
And then it's just, well, one model and brand compared with another and it becomes commoditized again.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, tough industry to be in.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Mm. Look, just before we finish up as well, last week, mentioned that sentiment was getting pretty frothy and that a correction was underway. Correction is underway. It started pretty much Friday night after our podcast. Don't get panicked by it. If we do have a bit of a sell-off here and it gets a bit deeper, this is normal. This is typical. Fundamentally, stock markets, global markets and global economy is on a strong footing. You should be looking to buy the dips and allocate to strength.
Actually, Joel, one more part of sort of your area of expertise. I noticed that Brexit's actually formally happening now. Any likely impact of that?
You know what? I missed that.
The announcement was made 2 nights ago.
Was it really?
Yeah. Okay. Apparently, as of tomorrow, I think the Brexit's formalised.
It is formalised,
yeah.
is it? Okay. Wow. No, I actually missed it.
Hasn't even popped on the radar.
No.
I saw it on the news.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. There you go.
So it says Brexit is here. So the deal with the EU and the UK has been
right.
done.
Right. Oh, well, I think the coronavirus has probably taken all of the headlines.
Yeah.
And yeah, Ash Barty losing and yep. yeah. So
yeah.
More important
for
yeah.
Australians.
Yeah. Oh, geez. All right, we'll be back after this short break.
Want to learn the strategies that have achieved returns more than double the return of the average superannuation fund? Each day, clients of United Global Capital are using strategies and tactics that were once thought the domain of the professional investor or the super rich. Book your seat at UGC's Financial Fast Track Seminars, where you'll learn the science behind selecting high-performance stocks and real estate, how you can participate in advanced strategies like property development, short selling, and international investments, as well as how to protect your wealth against major adverse market events. To secure your seat, simply go to ugc.net.au/events and select the seminar that suits your needs. Seats are limited, so book your spot now.
And welcome back. Now, Brett, last week's episode was featuring heavily in property news and all of our opinions on property.
Yep.
So surely there's not anything else property related to talk about.
Never is.
Covered sure, all of it yesterday.
Yeah.
There's no new news.
No, and nothing's changed in a week. But I thought given, well, tying in with what we kicked off today's episode about, you know, in terms of climate change and environmental sustainability, the bushfires have been a very contentious issue around, you know, climate change and how climate change, a lot of people believe that that was the biggest driver behind these bushfires being as big as and bad as they were.
Yeah.
And then on the back of that is, well, what is the impact of the bushfires on the economy? And there's been sort of an impact study on that in terms of how much it's going to cost the economy. But what does it do to real estate prices? Now, the interesting thing to figure out what does it do to real estate prices is, well, what does it do directly to real estate prices in the affected areas? But what does it mean for the rest of the market? Does it have a knock-on effect in some way?
Interesting.
Yeah.
So I've got a couple of pieces of information here that I think are worth just getting an understanding. So Risk, what's the name of this company here that did this? So someone did an assessment here just to talk about how they...
Someone.com.
Yeah, No, I'm well. Risk-wise. I haven't studied them.
Not someone.com. Brett's cousin.com.
Who knows? .com. So Risk-wise have put together a report, and they've categorized the areas into three of high impact, medium impact, and lower impact. So there was 152 suburbs in the high impact. So those were the ones that were severely impacted by the bushfire crisis. So directly had the fires through that area and more than likely had destructive houses and infrastructure.
Yeah.
Then there was the medium impact, 540 suburbs where homes were considered under threat and were possibly evacuated throughout the bushfire crisis. And then lower impact, where there was over 1,600 suburbs where they were issued with alerts and warnings as a precautionary measure.
Mm.
Now, in terms of actual homes that were devastated or destroyed, over 2,000 in New South Wales, around 400 in Victoria, 151 in South Australia, 48 in Queensland. Apparently, there were 5 in Northern Territory. I wasn't aware there was some bushfires up there.
Right.
2 in Tasmania and 1 in Western Australia.
Mm. Right.
Okay, so the Moody's analytics predicted that the economic damage of all of this was around $4.4 billion. Mm. And then we can compare it to the 2009 Black Saturday fires, where it was only 450,000 hectares of land compared to the over 10 million hectares of land that
really
were burnt this time. Yeah.
Jeez, that's so, 20 times bigger.
That's incredible.
Fire. Mm.
But what does that actually mean for the prices and the values in those impacted areas? Now, realestate.com have actually got some data here to talk about that. And their research based on all, obviously, they're able to look at bushfire suburbs and regions over their longer history of data collection and start to look at some trends and analysis. And they've been able to identify that the data shows that median house prices in the bushfire suburbs and regions is definitely impacted, but it can really vary significantly from one suburb to the next. And that's probably in line with a lot of property markets. They're all different. Yeah. Just because you've had bushfires in this area, are you coastal, are you regional, are you already a big population? You know, there's other things that are playing into this.
Yeah.
The part of what I thought was interesting is the net effect from their analysis was that in the long term, house prices increase faster in those regions than the rest of the state median growth, which is quite bizarre.
Interesting.
You think, how does that happen?
Yeah, how does that happen?
Right. The major reason they attribute it to is because new properties are being built, improving the quality of properties in that area so they're more valuable.
Go.
Right. So it's not that, you know, the resales are increasing. It's because so many new dwellings are being built in the area. They're better quality. They've got new protection in place. They're more valuable.
Yeah, gotcha.
So interesting stat.
Okay.
And also they say, look, there's some problems with the data too because bushfire prone areas are often more remote and therefore the properties are fewer and further between, so there's not as much data to collect and be able to analyse.
Yep.
And typically fewer properties per suburb so that the limited data is available. Of course, property views, so the amount of people looking to buy in bushfire areas, decrease initially, but increase as time goes on. So we've got short memories in a lot of ways.
Yeah, okay. Yeah,
so, of course, right now, anyone that's thinking of moving or buying in one of these areas that has been impacted is probably thinking, won't even look at it. But funnily enough, you probably think, well, now's the time where it's probably even safer because bushfire can't come back. It's all burnt out. Just whether it's desirable to live there. Is there enough other reasons to live there because of all the infrastructure and local community impact?
Having said that, I went for a motorbike ride up at Marysville, which was absolutely devastated during the bushfires on Black Saturday 10 years ago. And you wouldn't even know there was a fire that went through there.
Yep.
Mm. Yep.
All the regrowth's come through and it's...
Oh, yeah. The town's been rebuilt.
Yeah.
All that.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, let's look at Black Saturday as our... So now that we've, you know, 10 years since Black Saturday, we can have a look and say, okay, well, how have those suburbs that were severely impacted from Black Saturday performed over the long term? And this is really interesting that the a lot of these regions have actually grown in value more than the median of the rest of the state.
Right.
So I've got about 10 of them here that were listed as impacted in Black Saturday. So let's have a look. So Kilmore, over the last 10 years since then, average median is up 66%.
Right.
Wow. Okay. Geez. Okay.
But that's actually quite small. So King Lake, which was the one that was considered probably the most severely impacted or had a lot of the, you know, loss of life and bad house destruction, grown 150% in that time.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
And then Strathewen's actually gone up 230%.
Yep.
So of the 10 or so suburbs listed here, they're all in positive territory with the smallest being 40-odd percent in growth over 10 years and the highest at 230.
Yes. Look, I know those areas pretty well. I grew up there and mum and my stepfather actually have a farm in Strathewen.
Yep.
And I think what you'll probably find is that the price appreciation that's going on in those areas are driven by the urban sprawl continuing to move out.
Yeah.
You know, places like Hurstbridge and Wattle Glen and, you know, Diamond Creek over the last 10 years have gone through the roof because, you know, they're being priced out of the inner suburbs that were closer to Greensboro, Eltham, Bry Hill, where a lot of children who grew up in that area are being priced out of being able to get into their buying homes in those areas. So they're moving further out to the Lorimers and to Mernda and South Morang and, you know, out to Hurstbridge, Wattle Glen, these types of areas.
And look, Joe, you've nailed one of the points they've said in this report from realestate.com's analysis is that it's likely that many of these suburbs have become more desirable over time for other reasons.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we're talking about, obviously, the analysis is because they were affected by the bushfires 10 years ago, but... Yeah, they're areas that have had growth for more than reasons than just the bushfires have been rectified.
Okay.
Now, before we move on, the contagion effect in terms of what does it mean for other markets? So there was one piece of information I thought this is quite relevant. What it's more than likely going to do for some of the wrecked by the bushfires is it's probably going to have a lot of, we're sort of weighing up where they would like to move and retire to, are more than likely now going to stay closer to where they are currently living and look for downsizing units.
Oh,
and right, okay.
Where
okay.
they don't deem it, yeah, because they'll probably look at those bushfire areas and go, oh, it's not worth the risk for us later in life.
Yeah.
They might have the coastal dream or something, or regional
the
dream.
The sea change or the sea change tree or change.
The tree change. But, yeah, one train of thought is that you will more than likely see a higher percentage not do that and just look to downsize closer to where they're used to living.
Yeah,
okay.
Right.
Okay.
So which means you might see, more demand for, you know, those larger style, low maintenance type dwellings in more closer to the major capitals.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Where there's going to be an increase in demand anyway, just with the demographics of that population aging.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Very good data, Brett.
Thanks
for that. We'll take another short break and we'll be back.
Someone.com.
Are you concerned about your finances? Maybe you're not sure if you'll have enough money to retire on. Or maybe you've received a redundancy, inheritance, or even a significant promotion, or perhaps a life-changing medical diagnosis. Regardless of your concern or financial position, United Global Capital's advisors are experts in the areas of strategic financial planning, taxation, superannuation and self-managed superannuation funds, risk management, estate planning, and investments. Don't let fate dictate your financial future. Take control today and contact United Global Capital for a no-cost, no-obligation financial strategy consultation. Simply call 03-8657-7640 or email info@ugc.net.au and book your appointment today.
And hello again. Hope you're enjoying my husky voice.
Yes, you've been struggling with your voice this week, haven't you?
Yeah, I have.
Too much yelling.
came down with just a very small cold, but it coincided with me playing a couple of gigs
in
my band.
Right. You're your sax,
yeah,
mate.
That's right.
I play the saxophone and I do some backup vocals. Mm-hmm. And I had a gig on Sunday and then again on Monday, just at the time that my throat was getting a bit weak anyway.
Right.
And so by Tuesday, I just couldn't talk.
You wouldn't have done back-to-back gigs for a while.
No, I haven't done back-to-back gigs for a while. It's usually a rule that I don't, because usually they're at night time.
Mm.
And having a young daughter, if I only get home at midnight and then I'm woken up at 6 a.m. the next morning, I can do that once. But having it two nights in a row on a weekend just doesn't work.
It's tough.
But there was a daytime gig in there. So,
Was that Australia Day?
On Australia Day, that's right. Nice. On the Monday public holiday during the day, had a gig during the day then for a fundraiser. Actually a fundraiser for the Bushfire Relief Effort.
Oh, there you go.
So there you go. Very nice. And the benefit for our listeners is my wonderful voice.
Well, let's hear more of it.
So just quickly, something I read in the news was that Austria has just had elected what will be the youngest country leader in the world. Sebastian Kurz is the Austrian Chancellor at the age of 33.
33, righty-o.
Now, that's pretty young to be the political leader of a country. He has taken the mantle from who was the youngest. It was Finland who had the youngest prime minister, Sanna Marin, who was 34 when she became leader of her country.
And are these leaders that have been elected or voted in rather than
elected,
just a
family
hierarchy?
That's right. It's not monarchy who've just inherited the throne. Mm. Jacinda Ardern in New Zealand was prime minister at age 37 a few years ago. People who have come into it through a monarchy, well, Alexander the great conqueror of ancient times, he took over the throne at age 16 when his father died.
Really?
And 16? He was conquering countries by the time he was 18.
Far out. There you
what
go.
What about King Joffrey? How old was he?
Well, Alexander the Great was dead at 32. So he lasted a lot longer than King Joffrey did.
So he died before this current record holder was even in power in terms of age. Yeah.
That's right. He had. And there's, you know, lots of examples going into history of people reaching what can be considered a pinnacle at a young age.
Mm.
And there can be a lot of connotations about a young person either reaching such heights of success or being thrust into it too soon, called, you know, precocious, or people thinking that they haven't really earned their stripes or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And for me and my own personal pursuit of success and interest in what makes people successful got me starting to look at it in a bit more detail, or just exploring it a bit further. You look at other examples. So Mark Zuckerberg started Facebook when he was in college.
Yep.
Bill Gates got into tech when he was just a teenager.
Yeah.
Warren Buffett started buying shares when he was 11 years old.
There you go.
And what is it about these young people? Well, there are some advantages that they have over other people. I've read a few articles, and there's some which I clearly think are advantages, but then I read some other articles, and they're really just talking about success in general. So what I see is that people who start when they're younger, like if you started buying shares when you're 11 years old, by the time they're 30, well, a person who started at a younger age has got more experience than you do at the same age.
Yeah.
Or even if you're older, if you're mid-40s and you've got someone in their mid-30s who's now your boss, well, maybe they started 10 or 15 years before you did. But more importantly than the knowledge and the experience is that they've probably failed more times than you have.
Yeah,
and, by the time you've started in that career or specialty, they've already failed a few times.
Yeah.
Louis, does this tie in a little bit? Malcolm Gladwell wrote that book, was it The Outliers? The 10,000-hour rule he spoke about?
Correct. That's right.
That would be sort of relevant to this.
Absolutely. Yep. It's completely relevant for people who start their careers earlier or start their interest earlier. And the other thing is that habits are more easily adopted at a young age.
True.
So if you think of Warren Buffett and he starts buying shares at age 11, he probably learns how to research the financials of a company by age 15.
Yeah.
And that's where he forms a habit. Well, when I invest in shares, this is the process that I follow.
Yeah.
Or you look at someone like Gary Vaynerchuk, and he came into his family business and then opened the website that he did to sell wine online, and the habits that he started when he was in school. And he gives great examples of conversations with former high school buddies of his. And they come up to him and say, "Oh, Gary, you've been so lucky to have this success by age 30. And he says, "No, mate, because he's not Australian, but to translate into Australian, he says, "No, mate, I was working my face off while you were smoking weed behind the shed high school.
Exactly.
So, you know, look at what I did compared to what you did, and that explains the difference between you and me right now."
Yep.
But, you know, a lot of the other stuff that I see is no different being successful at a young age to being successful at any age. So writers say that young people particularly have high belief in themselves. Well, no, I think anyone who's successful has to have a measure of belief in what they do.
Yep.
They surround themselves with good people.
Yes.
Well, that's no different. They manage time well. They're able to accept failures and mistakes and learn from them and move on from them. They're able to educate themselves beyond just a high school education, beyond a university, or beyond even just on-the-job experience. They continue to educate themselves through books and seminars and reading blogs and podcasts and things. And they try often.
Mm.
The ability to fail and pick yourself up from that is one of the hugest things about being successful. So you look at some older people who have found their success. You look at the typical examples like Ray Kroc, who is the franchiser of McDonald's at age 52. He was a milkshake salesman.
Yeah,
that's the reason he went into the McDonald's store, the original McDonald's store. And he's like, "Oh, okay, here's an opportunity. Let's go for it."
Yep.
Colonel Sanders was 62 when he franchised KFC.
So you can start fast food franchises late in life.
That's right. When I was in high school, and you guys might remember the textbooks that you always had to buy and carry around. Do you remember, I don't know how to say it, Rogert's Thesaurus or Rogert's Thesaurus?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
He published that at age 73.
Wow.
Peter Mark Rogert. However you say that.
Yeah.
Apologies to the Froggett family.
Mm-hmm.
Charles Darwin was 50 years old when he wrote his book on what is now called Darwinism. And a lady named Gladys Birrell ran her first marathon at age 86.
Wow, 86.
I mean, come on.
Still hope for me yet.
Yeah, so...
Lots of years till then.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, that gives you permission, right, Joel?
Yeah.
You can just delay it until you're 83. Start your training then. So I don't think there needs to be any resentment or ill feelings towards people who find this success at a young age.
At an early age.
Because, you know, maybe they've got something that other people don't. Maybe they're the naturally talented. Maybe they're the extremely hard workers, or probably a combination of them. So thanks for joining us, listeners. We'll be back again with another episode. Stay tuned. Keep subscribing to our podcast and tell your friends about us.
Hopefully we might get to 1,000,001 subscribers next week.